A lady who has had a rather interesting experience over the last couple of years is on the line at the moment. Her name is Gillian Godsill. You're very welcome to the programme, Gillian.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sabina.
So I don't even know where to really start with your story. It's quite a long one. Some of our listeners may or may not be too familiar with you before now. You appear on a huge array of different media platforms. You're very big on social media. So anybody, you probably have some of our listeners following you on Twitter as well. But
maybe,
we're going to
yes.
take the story kind of from we're going to jump into it and into kind of the very recent past. You have recently
right.
declared yourself bankrupt.
Yes.
Okay. And of course, we have a lot of new insolvency issues at the moment. So tell us, first of all, how you went about declaring yourself bankrupt.
Well, I tried very hard not to go bankrupt because bankruptcy is still a very big issue, like a big hammer to crack a very small nut. And I tried, and I can reverse backwards again a little bit, but I tried very hard to negotiate with the banks over my debt, but they wouldn't speak with me. Or they just said no to various offers. I tried to use the insolvency service, which was new law brought in August of last year, August, September. And I had hoped to go that route because it's a slightly easier route. I was working with the Irish the Irish Mortgage Holders Organization with mm-hmm. David Hall. And they were leading me through the process. They had taken me on pro bono, which they do with people who've got no money, insolvents. And I tried to get in there, but I discovered to my horror, I was actually too broke to use the insolvency service, which is kind of a bit of an irony in itself, an oxymoron. And as a result, I had to go forward to bankruptcy, and I filed papers in January, and on the 17th of February, I was adjudicated bankrupt, and I believe, well, not certainly, I think I was maybe one of the first female bankrupts under the new laws.
And Gillian, tell me this, how have people reacted when you tell people that you are bankrupt? What is the look on their face?
It's like telling someone you're divorced. They got my divorce papers.
Which you are
also. They don't know whether to say, well, I'm also divorced if that happens, but they don't know whether to go, well done, or is that a good thing or a bad thing? And yeah, I think it is a good thing and a bad thing, because it's a good thing because obviously the whole purpose of bankruptcy is to extricate yourself from debts that you cannot repay. So from the minute that I'm adjudicated bankrupt, my debts are null and void, and that is super. But the bad thing is that it's the laws that are being brought in, they're not bad, they're better, but they're not. They're still a long way from being adequate and to reflect laws in other jurisdictions, which are a lot simpler and easier to use. So it is a bit tough. And I think also, I should say at this point, because I met someone yesterday, but you're a good kind of bankrupt. And I went, all right, okay.
So what's the bad kind?
Well, do you know what I think there is? And I think this is why I speak out a lot about this. There, we see evidence in the papers, certainly, a lot of very high-rolling bankrupts who have borrowed huge amounts of money, whose loans go into NAMA, who go through bankruptcy in different jurisdictions often. They go to the States, they do it in the UK, and their lives appear not to be affected. And their wives become very rich, because mostly men, as it happens. And sometimes they end up getting jobs from NAMA to manage their own portfolios, with the reason that they're the best people to know the business, which is sort of right, but they're paid very large salaries for doing this. So I think the if I may use the term, a bad bankrupt, is if you've got lots of money, do you know what? You can duck and dive and you can figure out something and you may lose, you know, millions, but you still have your nice house and your nice car and your holidays and all the rest of it. And then there are the rest of the other misfortunate people in this country who are facing into proper insolvency, by which I mean at the start of each month, they have paid their bills and they have no disposable income left over mm-hmm. and they cannot perhaps pay their mortgages. And those are the people who need desperate help. And those, I think, are the, when I say the good bankrupts, and people are having to use bankruptcy as a mechanism to get out of debt that they cannot cope with anymore.
Right. Okay. So there is different sides of it. Now, your own story started with buying a huge house in County Wicklow many moons ago.
Many moons ago, myself and my husband, we had a lovely living in Dublin, very nice lifestyle. He wanted to run a guest house. So we bought a ruin for very small money, I may say. And we did it. We literally was starting to fall down. We did it up, made this beautiful house, poured a fortune into it, I also be added. And we had this beautiful, beautiful house and a Georgian manor house with 8 bedrooms and 8 bathrooms and lovely gardens. And the idea was that we were going to run as a guest house. And then what happened then was that we didn't run as a guest house. My ex-husband didn't really, it's a tough business as well, but decided didn't want to do it. And my business was also had taken up quite well at that stage. It was kind of growing very fast in the booming economy. So we agreed that I would be the breadwinner mm-hmm. and that he would do projects around the house and stuff like that. And that suited me too as well, because running a guest house and running a business is a very busy thing to do. So I wasn't anti it. I was like, oh, phew, don't have to make beds then, thank the Lord. I'll just do what I'm good at doing. I'm not very good at making beds. But and that was grand and dandy until, and also, by the way, so because he wasn't working, he decided then, and this makes sense, right, at the time, that he'd try to create a pension for us by leveraging the equity in the house. We had a lot of equity in the house. It was worth 1.65 at one stage.
Right.
And so that was the idea, that we would buy the property with the view that in 10 years' time, we'd sell it and we'd sell the house and we'd, you know, retire and we would be grand and all the rest of it.
So you're taking, so just for people who, because a lot of these terms and a lot of these phrases would be quite, they wouldn't be very familiar to people. So if, when you're leveraging the equity, does that mean you take
we borrowed
the,
loads of money
on the back of this house?
Yeah, we extended our mortgage
right.
up to 800, which is a lot of money. But my business was very successful at that stage, so I was very easily able to pay it. So it didn't seem excessive. Plus, also, we you know our property that we had you know was maybe 2.5 million altogether. So it was seemed quite a rational thing to do. You know, in terms of business things, it seemed the idea was going to be short term. We'd sell in 10 years, and you know, hunky dory, right. that would be you know we'd retire with a few bob, and it'd be grand. And in sheer business terms, it made sense.
Of you course, know, I mean, when you write these things down and on paper, it looks like a foolproof plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that got me was I was hit with the double whammy of divorce and recession. And as I keep on saying, I could have survived one, but not both. The two of them did me in, you know.
Now, out of curiosity.
A mere woman.
Out of curiosity, Gillian, which do you think had the greater effect on bringing you to where you are now, the recession or
the divorce? The divorce, definitely. The recession, sure, money is only money.
Yeah.
Anyone can cope with that without things. But no, the divorce was very painful, very difficult, very expensive. I think I had nearly 100K in legal fees by the end of it. It was very convoluted, unnecessarily so. And I think, do you know what? I would love to give every separating couple a time machine and send them off 10 years in the future. And, you know, boys or boys, some different decisions will be made at the start. But sadly, it's not available to us. It wasn't available to us. It's not available to other people. And it was a very, very, very difficult time. And so definitely the divorce was much, much harder than mere money. But in financial terms, it did two things. One, it took up all the disposable income, if you like. All our investments went to pay the legal fees. And secondly, it also fried my brains because mm-hmm. it was such a hard time. I think I was a divorce zombie for a bit. I was kind of hang on to the kids, hang on to my business, hang on to stuff, whatever. And it was two to three years of extreme pressure. And that was very, very, very difficult. And anyone who's been through the process, especially a difficult divorce, and I don't think there are too many easy ones anyway, but it does. It sucks your life out and, you know, spits you out the far side, a very different person.
So what I'm taking from this is go ahead and buy property, but don't get married. It's too much. It's too much of a gamble.
No. The bottom line is, this is gold advice, right? Do not get divorced in a recession.
Okay. So,
divorce as much as you like, but not in a recession.
Right. So we fast forward a couple of years and all of a sudden you still have this house. Your husband has gone to England, I believe, and has declared himself bankrupt in England. What effect did this have on your position?
Devastating. Well, I mean, we concluded our legal separation here and then we divided. Full-time care of the kids, which you know, what we wanted. It was great. I was very happy about that. He went back to the UK and we agreed to share the debts. But he went back to the UK, he became bankrupt under the very lenient rules that they have there. So it made sense. Of course it made sense. He couldn't repay the stuff, so he went bankrupt. And within a year, his debts were all cleansed. But because under Irish law, when you buy a property together, you buy it jointly and separately. So as a result, no more than if my husband had died, when he became bankrupt, the entire mortgage became mine. And that was a problem because the mortgage was 800. During the 3 or 4 years of the divorce, payments were being very sloppy at this stage because the business was closing up. There was confusion. The kids and I had moved out, I think it was in 2008, whatever. We'd rented it out, but it wasn't enough rent to cover the mortgage. So the rent came in, went out to the banks, but the arrears were growing the whole time. And then I lost my last tenant, and the house was in a mess because I hadn't been looked after properly. And I went, what am I going to do? You know, I had all the debt now. Myself and the kids were now in hock for, you know, nearly a million. Mm. We had a house worth half that. And I was at my wit's end because all of a sudden my debt had doubled, if you like. And the responsibility was still there and everything was crazy. So I decided to make a video to try and sell the house. I mean, the house had been on the market since 2008, I may add. We had an offer of $1.1 million at that time, but that fell through. And no offers since because the market was crashing madly at that stage. So I made a video. A video went viral, and I got a cash offer of $500,000. A cash offer. I was delighted. And I went back to the banks and I said, look, here's $500,000. And the mortgage was $800,000 plus arrears. So I'm guessing, I don't really know. It's all funny money at this stage. Mm-hmm. And the banks refused consent to sell. They said, sorry, not the mortgage. Okay, sorry. Sorry, this might my set up. So the banks, they refused consent to sell. And I'm like going, what? And I couldn't, even though it's my home, I couldn't sell it. So the buyer went away. And I think that's the point, I think, when I didn't know it at the time, but that was the first step towards my bankruptcy. Up until then, I had a business, I was coping, I was hanging in there, you know, doing the business, whatever. And then when they didn't do that, I turned a lot of my energies into try and rescue the house. I tried to, I tried to crowdsourcing. I tried, the house also went quite far, I should point out, being quite a famous house. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, I can get somebody in, there'll be a white knight, some sort of business, I'll do weddings, I'll do loads of stuff. I spent a huge amount of time trying to save the house.
Right. And of course, this time as well, it doesn't come for free.
No. And I mean, it was my time, but it meant I wasn't putting time with my clients. Mm-hmm. So my clients were leaving me like rats leaving a sinking ship. Those are totally the wrong analogy. They were very good people, but I wasn't delivering the service. That sounds terrible. but that was a net effect. And they were dead right. They were 100% right because I was sinking. I wasn't giving them, they were beautiful passengers leaving the sinking ship. Because I'm not in PR, am I? No. But they were fantastic. They actually, in fairness, they hung on with me so long, they were brilliant, but I wasn't delivering service anymore because mm-hmm. I was sort of running around trying to save the house. My brain's a bit fried, and I wasn't concentrating on them, and that's what they were paying me for. So of course they left me, and the business sort of went, you know, further and further down the Swanee until I had a limited business, and then I stopped that, and I tried to sole trader for a year, and then at the end, the last year, I wasn't even paying my own salary; I was paying the salary of Maria, who was working to be a fantastic woman. And we did some great work too as well. Despite all the chaos, we did some fantastic projects and we were really vibrant and alive and it was super. But I remember in August 2012, I didn't really have enough money to pay Maria.
Right.
And I dug some money out of the rubbish bin or something. I can't remember how.
You caught into that mattress.
If I'd had a mattress, it would be lovely. But I paid Maria and I said, I can't do this anymore. And I retired home to lick my wounds. And you know what? For the next 6 months, I was a debt zombie. I would get up and do the school run, and then I go back to bed again. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't see anything. And those 6 months were incredibly humbling for me. And I don't want to use the word humanize. That's not the wrong word. But I understood what it's like to lose hope. Because up until that point, in my entire life, either as a young person comforted in my own family home, my great parents and family, or as a working adult and even as a wife, whatever, I'd always been able to look after myself, always been able to mm-hmm. provide for myself and provide for my children. And for those 6 months, I was in a hole. I couldn't get out, and there was no way I could get out, and I couldn't do anything. And it really made me understand the terrible, terrible situation of people when they contemplate suicide and they take the step. Now, I have two kids, so fortunately, thank God, thank the universe, thank the gods, thank whoever, I didn't go that step. But I understood what it was like not to have any hope. And that was horrible. That was really, really, really horrible.
So at this point, just about 18 months ago, was the point where you felt like you had completely lost the battle?
Totally. Utterly. Utterly. I was a zombie. Literally. I mean, when the kids would come home from school and work, so I'd be there at the computer. The house would be a mess. Now, I'm not tidy the best of it, but the house would be a mess. No dinner on. I kind of wake up and I'd jump around and pretend to make dinner and pretend that I was busy working all day. I'd been staring at a computer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd done nothing. I'd achieved nothing. And it was just, and I didn't even realize, it wasn't until afterwards that I realized that I was actually depressed. I had no concept. I didn't know what had hit me. Well, it was like a juggernaut. It ran right over me. And it left me totally floored and not capable of doing anything. You know, I don't know what I did in those 6 months. From just the, no idea.
I assume listeners at this point have kind of figured out that you're a very vivacious, kind of bubbly kind of personality. So I assume that you had been running on some kind of fight and an adrenaline up to this point, and all of a sudden it was just completely zapped. Now, for those 6 months, you've described what it was like to us. Was there a turning point where you just suddenly snapped back out of that again and, you know, decided, okay, what was the next step?
Well, I think as I approached the end of 2012, I was adamant I was going to go to the north to go bankrupt, because I kept calling it the stinking corpse of death, of debt, sorry, DBT, that I was dragging around the place. You know, I had to get rid of it, and I couldn't, you know, wait for the laws to come in here, and I couldn't. I mean, that was 2 years ago. I couldn't wait for anything. And then I couldn't move to the north because I couldn't afford to. I couldn't afford to lose my job find the lands. I couldn't leave my kids behind, and they were happy in their school and their work, so, you know, that I couldn't move them. And I just couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that I had to stay here. There wasn't an easy out. And I think I just, it was my kids, you know, I thought, well, you know, they've had this debt zombie mum for the last 6 months. It's not fair. They're now 20 and 17. They're brilliant kids. You know, I'm not going to let this dictate my life. And you know, I have a short time on this earth. I have a short time with my children who are still at home with me. I'm not going to let it get the better of me. And I guess I started to believe in myself at that stage, you know, and I started writing, a lot of writing, and I did a lot of applying for jobs. And I hit that thing where, oh gosh, you know, I hit three stumbling blocks. One was, I've been self-employed for most of my adult life, mm-hmm. and that's very hard to get PAYE jobs. Secondly, I'm hitting that magic age. Next year, I'm 50. So that's kind of, you become kind of a grey woman, you know, that you're invisible. And then thirdly, it's kind of ironic, I was more highly qualified than the people, you know, doing the job searches, or whatever, doing the hiring. Yes. And that wouldn't have endeared myself either. So I applied for jobs where I should have got interviews. I wasn't even getting them. And then I went back and had an argument with some of the people. I won no favors there either. But I was quite cross going, why didn't you interview me? You know, I can do this job, my eyes closed, my hands tied behind me. And they said, oh, no, they had different reasons, whatever, but oh, no. And that was very frustrating, because all of a sudden I couldn't get clients. I couldn't do work. I was writing. That's the only thing I was doing. I was writing, was keeping me sane, but I was just floundering, I guess. And what killed me was that I was recently with my social worker. I have a case officer. I sound like a criminal now, whatever. And it turns out I'm long-term unemployed now. I'm 2 years now, almost 2 years mm-hmm. in receipt of social payments, which is quite frightening. So when I started talking again to the IMH. Oh, beg your pardon. Sorry. Just before Christmas in 2012 as well, I got the court papers that were going to repossess the house.
Right, okay.
And then, so I thought, I almost forgot about the house and all this. And then in February, at my first court hearing in Bray, in the Circuit Court, I went in there and I said to the woman, oh, I had another offer on the house, it was $220 at this stage, and it dropped that much, but I had an offer. And I went in and the judge of the county register said, what's the story? I said, well, I have an offer, they won't talk to me. And she tore into the young solicitor for the bank, and she said, you talk to this woman, she's a human being, you know, you give her rights. Probably sold her debt down to hedge funds in Europe. And I was like, wow. And said, if you don't talk to them, I'll strike out this case. I walked out of that courtroom, you know, 10 feet high. I was delighted. I went back the next month. Oh, I was so cocky. I didn't bring any friends, anybody. I was by myself. I had a book to read. You know, I was so cocky. I went up and I said, they haven't spoken to me. They haven't taken my offer. But I think between then, between the two dates, that thing about the legal loophole about repossession, whatever, being removed, whatever. But all she said was, what's the mortgage? I said, it's 800. So what are the arrears? I said, it's about 200. And she said, is it unsustainable? I said, well, yes. And she signed the order.
Right.
I went, ooh, I'm not a human being anymore. You know, and I mean, the banks, why didn't they take it? And it turned out the sheriff came in August of 2013 and took the house. I wasn't there. I didn't make him tea. up in Dublin. So he came and the house was unoccupied. And then I found out that it sold this year, at the start of this year, for less than 160.
Right.
Original value.
So when we actually look at the different figures that are coming from this, it was bought for quite a significant amount of money, but not you know, nothing major.
No, we would have paid about 100k for pounds.
Right.
We put about 400 euros, we're mixing my metaphors now, my currencies, into it, because we spent a lot of money into it. So it's probably the value in hard cash, maybe 500 went into it, euros. It was valued at 1.65. We had an actual offer of 1.1, so that's a definite offer as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, a mythical valuation. And we had an offer then of 500, 220 and it sold for 160.
Right. So, I mean, a couple of years ago, you know, somebody could have given you €500,000 cash. You could have walked away and tried to service a loan of, you know, just north of €300,000. I mean, do you think that you could have managed a €300,000 debt?
I could have had a fighting chance. A fighting chance, I think, because, and maybe I could have done deals because I'm now doing, you know, debt forgiveness, which are another point I'd like to give a little about language, the language surrounding bankruptcy. But I think I had a fighting chance. I still had a business. If you think about it, my business at one stage was capable of paying $800 without any bother. You know, so there was no reason why I couldn't have serviced that loan or done something or, you know, I don't know to be sure, but it certainly, it killed me off. And also, say that all the time that I spent in trying to fight the banks and fight the injustice and fight, you know, trying to find someone to fix the house, to make it, you know, to give it back, you know, to give back the loan, that robbed me of so much of my commercial time as well.
Of course. Now, so the choice to actually declare yourself bankrupt, now the rules and the restrictions have changed quite considerably around bankruptcy over the last while. So before it was, you were bankrupt for 12 years, now it's 3 years. What other changes were there?
Okay, well, you used to have to pick up full page ads in the papers. The modern equivalent of going into stocks. I'm a bankrupt, oh, woe is me, you know. And I think people would seem to forget that. And again, for a lot of ordinary people are going bankrupt. I think there were 40 in court last week. There's a lot of people who are having to use this.
Sorry, 14 or 40?
40, I believe. I spoke with someone who said there were 40 people in court.
Wow, okay.
It's a bit of a little tsunami because there's no other way out of it. So with the new laws that have come in, it's gone from 12 to 3. Actually, the old law, it was totally punitive because it could be for life. You couldn't actually pay your debts. So it came from 12 down to 3 years, which is to be welcomed. But I had my meeting with the officials in the bankruptcy department, whatever. Very polite, very nice people, nothing but kindness and niceness from them. But they were saying a couple of things. First off, although I'm technically debt-free of the house and the mortgage and all the rest of it, any debts that I incur in the next 3 years are mine and mine alone. Any assets that I may, you know, win in the lottery, whatever, they will take them.
In 100% in its entirety?
Well, pretty much. You're only allowed, I think the allowance is like $1,800 a month. So if I won a lottery, I wouldn't see much of it now. I don't know exact amounts, but yes, if I won a lottery, if I won a big sum, they would take, I don't know, 90% or whatever. It's huge. And then the other thing too as well is that if I get gainful employment, they can slap. At the moment, I'm below the income, the guidelines. But if I went above those guidelines in any way, shape, or form, up to and including the very last day of my bankruptcy, the three-year period, they can slap a further five-year judgment against my salary going forward. So in net effect, they could, and they said that they probably would, if they could, you know, if I had a good salary, do it on. So that's like 5 years and three, that's 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
That makes no sense. Because I think at the end of the day, again, when most people, when they're bankrupt and they're insolvent, whatever, I mean, I've lost my house, my savings, my business, everything went belly up. So, you know, that's tough. And I'm not going to perm you. And it was tough. It was tough on very, very, very many levels. But, you know, why am I still being kicked when I'm down? And I know it's better, but why not make it like 1 year so I can lick my wounds, say, I'm really sorry, guys, I failed, you know, and, you know, cause all this anxious, you know, and I worked very hard and I didn't manage to do it. I'm really sorry. And then give me incentive to go out and start earning again properly, maybe employing people, maybe creating wealth, maybe contributing to the community again. There's no incentive. And I have met with various other PIPs who say, they tell their client, and not on the record, off the record, don't bother getting a job, don't bother getting an increase, because you know what, it'll be taken from you.
Well, this is kind of the point. This is kind of the opposite argument that can be made here, is that you have been alleviated of a considerable amount of debt. So, of course, nobody wants to be, you know, nobody wants to use any kind of punishment terms here, and kind of, you know, nobody wants to be punished for these things, and nobody would like to see anybody else being punished for these things. Yeah. But of course, there has to be some kind of, I don't want to use the word, but there has to be some kind of punishment almost for it.
Well, I don't think, I think that's my bottom line. I think that there doesn't have to be punishment. If people fail financially, they're not criminals. Mm-hmm. They haven't done anything wrong as a rule. I'm not talking about fraud. You know, people who fail financially, it isn't a crime. They've normally worked very hard for what they've done, and circumstance can derail them. It could be, you know, recession. It could be job loss. It could be you know, just income reduction, divorce, ill health, you know, there's a whole rake of things that can throw people off course. And when people actually get to the bankrupt stage, now, I would like the banks to have taken parity of risk, because when I borrow that money on that asset, and this is pure like banking terms, like this, there's no emotion here, right? I borrowed money on an asset. The banks were the professional. I wasn't. They evaluated the value of the asset and my ability to repay that the money they were going to loan me. Fair enough. Now, if they got it wrong, now they couldn't have foreseen, obviously, what was going to happen either, but if they got it wrong, there should be parity of responsibility and parity of risk. So I lose everything. Guess what? If they had taken the 500 grand offer, they would have lost a certain amount of money. It's not a huge amount, because in banking terms, loans are securitized. They have hedge positions. I paid enough interest probably to cover the cost of them borrowing the money to lend to me in the first place, you know, on the interbank, I think. So the parity of risk thing comes into play there, because the asset, I should be able to hand the key back on the asset and say, guess what, guys? I'm losing the asset, which is very painful for me. You're losing some income on the loan that you sent out. Let's both shake hands and walk away. You know, why should the banks not be punished and I get punished?
There are arguments there to be made for both sides. I think as well, a lot of people would look at, you know, for if you want the banks to take responsibility, there also has to be a certain amount of personal responsibility. That
absolutely, yeah. And I put my hand up, I take it all, and I've lost my house, and I've lost I'm 50, so I've lost 30 years of work of salaries, because I didn't get my money from speculation, whatever. So my 30 years of my salaries went in to create that one asset. And it's gone. So 30 years of my life, my working life, is gone. So I think I've taken quite a big hit. And, you know, in terms of what I've lost and having ground zero and owning a fridge freezer. So, you know, and it's a very old fridge freezer. It's an American one. But it's 10 years old or 15 years old. I don't know. And it freezes the carrots in the bottom. It's useless. But so I think we need to step back a bit. And I think the part of the thing is people get into debt and they get into trouble, and like you lose stuff. And I have no problem losing stuff. I'm just saying, let's treat it like a business operation, which it is, and let's figure out ways to extricate people, banks and lending institutions and individuals and businesses, in as fair and as reasonable a method as possible. I think that's what we need to do, rather than saying, I'm going to punish you, you did wrong. You know, I didn't actually do anything wrong. I worked very hard and I've lost everything. I'm going, okay, I'm a big girl, I don't mind that. But don't vilify me or punish me for trying to do what's right, you know, or trying to earn a living and getting it wrong, getting divorced, you know. Things happen. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be an easy way a dignified and elegant way to extricate people and financial institutions, with giving them parity of risk and parity of responsibility and parity of, politeness going forward.
Now, Gillian, just to move to the last few days, one of the conditions that have been imposed on you due to your bankruptcy is you cannot hold public office. Now, you have taken a rather unusual stance, an unusual action towards this by declaring that you're going to run.
Yes, well, I'm actually allowed to run for local elections.
Okay.
So I'm doing that in the Wicklow West, from up to Balting Glass. I'm living in Coolboy, in the Healy area, up to Balting Glass. And I'm also contesting the fact that I'm not allowed to run in the Europeans.
Okay.
So I'm saying that my constitutional right is being denied.
So you can run in local elections, but you can't run
not in... European.
Can you run
not
for the
European,
Dáil?
Not the Dáil.
Okay.
No, so I'm contesting that also. Because, I mean, if I was a murderer, I could run for the Dáil. And if I was, if I went bankrupt in the UK, I could run for the Dáil. Because I got bankrupt in my own country, I can't run for the Dáil or for Europeans. It's an anomaly. It makes absolutely no sense. It's like the fact when people had to take the big page ads out to say that they were bankrupt. Shame, name and shame. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Now, I'm going to assume that you're not running on a platform to fill in potholes or... you know, there's a very specific platform
that you're
running. I
actually have a very cunning plan. You know, I would tell you my platform for the local election. Well, the main thrust is, first of all, is I am very concerned to stop the vilification of people in debt and to bring in good and elegant law the first time around that is reasonable and responsible to all parties. People are going to, if you're practical, you lose houses, that will happen, but to do it in a responsible way that is also courteous to the citizens of the state that the banks do not run roughshod over people, which they're doing at the moment. Mm-hmm. The second thing is I would also be very conscious of the number of suicides and the high rate of immigration as a result of this treatment. And I would like to destigmatize, because it's not, he was saying, I failed financially, but I didn't commit a crime. Now, it hurts on so many different levels, on my pocket, obviously, on my emotions, on my intellect, on my, you know, social standing, everything. And sorry, my thing. But I'm not ashamed of it. Mm-hmm. I worked very, very hard. I've worked hard all my adult life. I will continue to work hard. And I don't feel ashamed of it. But I want to get the message across of people who are feeling really, really, you know, in a tight place and they can't see out. And they are committing suicide. It's 2 to 3 a day. I'm not saying they're all financial, and you can't necessarily do causality and effect, but it's pushing people over the edge. Suicide's up 7%. So those are my two big points. Stop the vilification of ordinary people in debt. Give a fair crack to everybody. Because if you think about it, if you borrow money, you know exactly what you'll get. You'll know because based on your age, your occupation, where you live, your credit rating, how many kids you have, whether you smoke or not, whatever, you pretty much know what you're going to be able to borrow. The same way when you need to leave debt, why isn't there transparency? Why are people suddenly getting deals and some aren't, and some high rollers get big deals and other people don't? It should be transparent and it should be a fair crack for everybody. So those are two debt things I'm very concerned about. Mm-hmm. And the other thing then too is with Wicklow in particular, I have a lot of skills. I've actually worked for JP Morgan in London, as it happens, ironically, my first job. I've worked in Singapore, Australia, America, and I've worked for large corporates. I've worked for I've been an entrepreneur. I've had my own business. I've employed people. I've also seen my business fail. I've had bailiffs come. I'm 2 years unemployed, and I'm bankrupt. So I have a lot of experience I'd like to turn into an asset and bring it for the people of Wicklow. And I also am very good at marketing as my one core strength. And I would like to use my skill set, that particular skill set in Wicklow, to help market Wicklow, put it on the map for Ireland, but also put it on the map for the world, because obviously we live in a global economy these days, mm-hmm. and help promote the arts, the tourism, the businesses, the lakes, the fields, you know, the festivals, whatever, and use my marketing ability to help the county, help raise the county.
Very good. So it won't be a one-trick pony just about debt. You are actually running to be a very, very serious, well-rounded candidate.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, there's no point putting me in this, say, oh, debt's terrible, you know, because that's a national issue. I mean, I think it's very important to have forums, to have discussions, to talk about it. And, I mean, you're right to say, gosh, Jill, I think, you know, maybe there's an element, you know, people might say about punishment. And for me to argue strongly back mm-hmm. and say, no, I don't think there is, you know, but to have that conversation, I'm not ashamed. You know, I think to have a conversation, we can have different viewpoints, but let's talk about it. You know, yeah. With the suicide example, just interesting, you probably are too young to remember this, but a number of years ago, cancer was not spoken of.
Yes.
If someone had cancer, they'd say, oh, the C word. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't mean the rude one. And, you know, it was quite a funny thing. Nowadays, people talk quite openly about cancer, but suicide is still not there yet. I mean, it's more so because it's more prevalent, but it would be nice for the families and for people to be able to talk about it more openly, to recognize the symptoms, intervene where necessary, or, you know, hopefully to help people. And if it does, if the ultimate has happened, to be able to, for the family to be able to talk about it or to grieve for their loved one without feeling the guilt and the stigma on top of it again.
Gillian, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. There's just so much we could keep going for absolute hours here. I do wish you the best of luck in the High Court. I'm sure you will be commenting on this an awful lot. We'll be back in touch with you again, because I'm very curious to see what comes from the High Court challenge there for being able to contest the elections in Europe.
Well, thank you so much for listening to me rant and rave here. I'm very, you know, I'm a very proud Irish woman, but I would be very, very humbled if more than one person, i.e. myself, votes for me. You know, I would be very, very honoured, because it's a different thing. You know, I recognise that I'm going into a different territory here. So while I'm a proud Irish woman and I would fight my case for the people with debt, I would also be very humbled and honoured if people decided to vote for me. So thank you very much for allowing me the time to talk about it.